This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Russian roulette. Who is playing Russian roulette? Is it President Trump or is it the media? Is it President Trump or the D.C. establishment? Is it President Trump or the so-called deep state? We keep hearing about Russia. Who's right? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. This is Jerry Johnson, president of NRB, National Religious Broadcasters. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins, who's on the Alaska cruise with the FRC team. And he'll be back. But today, we're going to talk also about a designer baby coming to you by way of genetic engineering. Are we ready for this? Should we want this? What does it mean? And we're going to talk about an inconvenient truth, about Al Gore's house. Is he a hypocrite? And finally, what do you think about immigration? Not illegal immigration, but legal immigration. That's been in the news this week. How much and what kind is right, is good? But first, Russia. Russia. We keep hearing about Russia. President Trump and Russia. The media keeps talking about it. The Democrats keep talking about it. The deep state leaks keep coming out about Russia. And it's all in critique of Trump. And surprisingly, he keeps talking about Russia. Who is right? Trump or the media? Trump or the D.C. establishment? With us to talk about it is Dr. Richard Land. He's president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And he's been with the president in the West Wing in just the last couple of weeks. Dr. Land, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Johnson. And the one thing you didn't say was is that I was once your professor.
That's right. He was.
And that you were one of the very best students I ever had.
Well, thank you, Dr. Land. Well, look, I want you to do something here with me. Yesterday, the president was in West Virginia and talking to the coal miners. He said they're the backbone of America. And at this rally, the governor of West Virginia was there. He was a Democrat 48 hours ago. Today, he's a Republican. So the people were there cheering on Trump. And the Democrat governor was there to say, tomorrow I'm becoming a Republican. And I want you to listen for a moment to President Trump, what he says about Russia. He's not afraid to talk about it. And I want you to hear the people responding. And I want your thoughts on this. Here we go.
And they should be looking at the paid Russian speeches. And the owned Russian companies, or let them look at the uranium she sold that is now in the hands of very angry Russians. Most people know there were no Russians in our campaign. There never were. We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you. That I can tell you.
We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you. Dr. Land, I'm here on Capitol Hill. This is where I work, in the swamp, as they call it. You know, the news has been breaking today about a grand jury that the special counsel has put together to look into this and that about Russia and the family and about the money. You'd think Trump might not talk about it, but actually he just embraces the theme and he pivots to talk about the Democrats or to talk about the Clintons in Russia. What do you make of this?
I think it's an attempted coup d'etat. Hmm. I think that on Inauguration Day, President Trump declared war on the bipartisan Washington establishment, the leadership of both parties, the civil service, the deep state, and they were listening. Mm. And they're out to decapitate the government of the United States. They're out to remove the president from office. Mm. Now, among the many reasons that I'm not the president of the United States is that if I were the president of the United States, I would hold, I would make a national address to the nation from the Oval Office. I would put up on the screen the part of the law that says that a special counsel cannot serve as special counsel if there is an apparent conflict of interest. How Mr. Mueller cannot have an apparent conflict of interest when he's investigating one of his best friends and colleagues,
yes,
Comey, is beyond acceptance. And if I were the president of the United States, I would then announce the reasons why, and I would fire the special counsel right now.
Wow.
Because they are going, I mean, look at who he's hired for his staff. Look at what they're now expanding. They're all over the place. They're going from supposed Russian collusion, which if they were just going to investigate Russian collusion in the election, that'd be over. They'd shut it down. So now they're going after the president's tax returns back to 2000 or so. They're going after all of his business dealings. They're going to find something. And they're going to indict the president of the United States. And when that happens, we're going to have civil war in this country. You listen to those people in West Virginia last night. They're not going to let the Washington establishment remove their president from office. They're just not going to do it. And so, for the sake of the country, if I were the president of the United States, I would fire Robert Mueller tonight.
Wow. Well, I'm going to invite callers to join in here. That is a bold proposal. 866 is the number. 372-7234. What do you think about President Trump versus the media, President Trump versus the deep state, 866-372-7234? You're on Washington Watch, and you have an opportunity to talk to Dr. Richard Land. Dr. Land, it was very interesting that the Washington Post actually reported in the last week that the collusion story is dissolving. It's fading. It's right. Disintegrating. And
it was a mirage. It was a mirage. In fact, if you believe the reporting that's been done recently, Seymour Hersh, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter,
yes,
is on tape saying that it was invented by the securities agencies as a way to discredit the president.
And he's no conservative, by the way. Cy Hersh is not a conservative.
Trust me, as someone who lived through the Vietnam War era, he is no one's conservative.
So literally, the collusion story is being pushed to the back burner, and now it really is a kind of a witch hunt.
Well, these things have a way of doing that. I mean, you know, Ken Starr started by investigating Whitewater, and he ended up dealing with Monica Lewinsky, pretty far from an Arkansas land deal.
Yeah, well, I would say so. Let's go back to the president for just a moment. We've got more sound from this rally, and I want to listen again to the president and the people. And folks, we'll take your calls, 866-372-7234. Here's President Trump in West Virginia.
We won because we totally outworked the other side. We won because millions of patriotic Americans voted to take back their country. Have you seen any Russians in West Virginia or Ohio or Pennsylvania? Are there any Russians here tonight? Any Russians? They can't beat us at the voting booths. So they're trying to cheat you out of the future and the future that you want. They're trying to cheat you out of the leadership you want with a fake story that is demeaning to all of us, and most importantly, demeaning to our country and demeaning to our Constitution. I just hope the final determination is a truly honest one, which is what the millions of people who gave us our big win in November deserve. And what all Americans who want a better future want and deserve.
Folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Jerry Johnson filling in for Tony Perkins. We've got Dr. Richard Land on the line with us. Dr. Land, your reaction to that soundbite from West Virginia last night?
Well, it's, you know, what I said before. He clearly is speaking for millions and millions and millions of Americans.
Yes.
Who, as he said in his inaugural address, with very good reason, believe that there is a bipartisan establishment in Washington that exists for its own benefit and its own self-preservation and has turned its back on the people that elected them to govern. And this is a struggle to the death. I mean, I'm telling you right now, what you saw the other day in the press conference is what I would do all the time. He's never going to assuage these people. They hate him. They hate everything he stands for. And so the only way to deal with them is to understand that any press conference is hand-to-hand combat.
Okay, quickly, you've referenced that press conference. This is incredible because CNN's Jim Acosta really went on attack. And
who, by the way, is a pitiful, pitiful excuse for a reporter, and who paraded his own ignorance, and is so ignorant that he doesn't know that he was undressed in public.
Well, let's listen to this exchange between Jim Acosta and Stephen Miller.
Came to this country in 1962, right before the Cuban Missile Crisis, and obtained a green card. Yes, people who immigrated
okay,
to this
so,
country
so Jim,
can eventually. People who
so Jim,
immigrated
as a factual
to this country
question,
through,
Jim,
not through
Jim,
Island,
as a factual, Jim, as a factual question.
Ways, do obtain a green card at some point. They do it through a lot of hard work. And yes, they may learn English as a second language later on in life.
So,
but this
Jim,
whole notion of, well, they could learn, you know, they have to learn English before they get to the United States. Are we just going to bring in people from Great Britain and Australia?
Jim, as actually, I have to honestly say, I am shocked at your statement that you think that only people from Great Britain and Australia would know English. It's actually, it reveals your cosmopolitan bias to a shocking degree that in your mind, no, this is an amazing moment that you think only people from Great Britain or Australia would speak English is so insulting to millions of hardworking immigrants who do speak English from all over the world. Jim, have you honestly never met an immigrant from another country who speaks English outside of Great Britain and Australia? Is that your personal experience?
Sure, of course there are people who come.
But that's not what you said. And it shows your cosmopolitan bias. And I just want to say,
sounds like you're trying to engineer the racial and ethnic flow of people into this country.
Jim, that is one of the most outrageous, insulting, ignorant, and foolish things you've ever said.
Oh, so Dr. Land, we've only got a minute here. But what just happened in that exchange?
Well, it revealed the ignorance and the bias of the press corps, and the poster child for that is Mr. Acosta, who is a disgrace to his profession. Mm. Their basic assumption every day when they get up is, President Trump has obviously done something really terrible. Now let's go find out what it is.
Well, that is an illustration.
That's their basic posture. The idea that you know we should require that people get preference, not excluding people who don't speak English. We're going to give it's that point system, and they get points for already speaking English. And Indians speak English, Pakistanis speak English, Russians speak English.
Well, you're right. We've got to go, Dr. Land. Thank you for being with us. When we come back, we'll talk about designer babies.
Is there a cost to free speech? For nearly 40 years, Washington and much of the American public have held up disclosure and campaign finance laws as ideals and the path to cleaner and freer elections. In her book, The Intimidation Game, Kimberly Strassel provides firsthand accounts concerning how both have been hijacked by the left as weapons against free speech and free association, becoming the most powerful tools of those intent on silencing their political opposition. The book provides a chilling expose of political scare tactics and overreach, such as how Citizens United set off a wave of liberal harassment against conservative politicians and the targeting of Tea Party groups by the IRS. Listen to Ms. Strassel as she discusses about her national bestseller, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, which chronicles recent attacks on conservative nonprofits, businesses, and donors at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
In America today, religious freedom, national borders, and even traditional gender roles are in peril. With all that's happening in our world, our nation is in desperate need of a return to conservative values. Hello, I'm Buddy Smith, Senior Vice President of American Family Association. One of the best ways we can make a difference is with our vote. That's why each year the American Family Association is a sponsor of the Values Voters Summit to help increase cultural engagement. This year's Values Voters Summit will be October 13th through the 15th in Washington, D.C. The growing list of confirmed speakers includes people you hear on AFR like Ed Battagliano and Tawny Perkins, as well as Michelle Bachman, George Barna, Gary Bauer, the Benham Brothers, and more. The Values Voters Summit is sponsored in part by AFA Action. To learn more and to register, you can visit valuesvotersummit.org.
Who says you can't have your cake and eat it too? If you're like a lot of people, you would like to support the culture-changing efforts of the American Family Association. But there's the very pressing reality that your income must meet your current needs as well as act as seed for future income, either for the short term or for life. A charitable gift annuity might be your answer. A charitable gift annuity offers a unique method for both planning ahead for permanent income and supporting the work of the American Family Association. An AFA Foundation representative will walk you through the details of creating a charitable gift annuity, allowing you to decide if a charitable gift annuity is right for your individual financial situation. Connect with us today by calling 800-326-4543, extension 345, or visit us online at afafoundation.net.
Folks, it's Jerry Johnson filling in for Tawny Perkins. In a moment, we're going to talk about designer babies and an amazing revelation that happened just in the last week. But we've got callers on the line holding to talk about this exchange between the media and the White House and how partisan it's become. We've got Iris on the line. Iris, what do you make of that?
I'm so proud of them for our president making a firm statement, his representatives, and I think he should continue. And I'm all in agreement with Dr. Land about firing Schumer, and I pray that other Christian leaders will speak into him and that he will have the wisdom to do that. And I just want to make one other comment to you. I listened to you from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and you were instrumental in opening my eyes to a Christian worldview and being a part of the culture world wars. And now I am a mighty intercessor. I spend a lot of time praying for these issues and being a voice. So thank you for, you'll never
Thanks,
know
Iris.
What you have done in my life.
Well, thank you, Iris, on behalf of FRC and Tawny Perkins. I know they want your prayers. We certainly at NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, want and need your prayers, and please continue to pray for us. Yes, I think Jim Acosta there at CNN has really crossed the line. In fact, there's a story out there brewing that off the record, some of his CNN colleagues believe he's really gone over into partisanship. And that's saying a lot for the CNN crowd to feel that way, because that's generally what most of them do. But he's ramped it up another notch or two. He reminds me of Ted Baxter on Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, it's almost a comical figure. In fact, just to accentuate Miller's point, there are more English-speaking people in India than any country in the world, including the United States, including Great Britain. I mean, that's a country with over 1 billion people, and there are more English-speaking people in India than here. And for him to say, oh, you're only for Anglo, you're only for people from England or Australia or something like that, again, was insulting, and it was just absolutely false. Well, we've got Bob on the line. Bob, what are your thoughts about this battle between the press and the president?
Well, I think what Dr. Richard Land, what he said was a very, very smart, intelligent, maybe the only way to go. Hey, sometimes it's almost like it's a, some kind of game they're playing or something. But you know what? I really don't think it's a game, and I'm with Dr. Richard Land. This is serious business, and there's a lot of things going on right now, a lot of nefarious. And he's right about something else. It's just not against President Trump. It's against our way of life. It's against our culture. It's against Christianity. And that's what Trump, President Trump is for. And if this is not any type of game, I've been, you know, everything he said is, I think it's really serious. And I think he needs to fire Robert Mueller as soon as possible because there's a conflict of interest. And you know, we're, maybe on the precipice, you know, this is a fragile republic right now, and I think the people are tired of just tired of wrongdoing and evil, and they see all this bad stuff going on, and they're tired of it, and they want something like what President Trump's talking about. Mm. So, yeah, I think he needs to fire Robert Mueller as soon as possible, unless it's some kind of game, you know, so...
Incredible.
Now, thank you for the opportunity to talk on the radio program.
Well, thank you, Bob, and thank you for listening. Folks, I mean, what we heard Dr. Land say, he said this is a coup by another name. Now, we're not used to that in America. I mean, if we lived in Central America or South America or maybe even other parts of the world, that's something that's typical, and that someone would seize power or remove someone else from power apart from the ballot box, usually there's maybe a military coup or junta that, you know, overthrows. And, you know, what Dr. Land was saying is this is the D.C. establishment or the deep state. Fascinating. We're going to pick this up later in the program and actually talk about the subject of debate, which was the numbers on legal immigration. But just briefly for a moment, I mean, there was an amazing story this week about designer babies. Something happened in Oregon, and we've asked Wesley Smith to come on the program with us. He's the senior fellow of the Discovery Institute and the program chair for their Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thank you for joining us on the program.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and hello to your listeners.
Wesley, we've actually come down with just a couple of minutes, but I think... You know, you are the expert here. Tell us what happened in Oregon and why we should be concerned as pro-life Americans here.
Well, there's two things that have happened, and the second is the Oregon. The first is human cloning has actually been accomplished. They have not brought human clones to birth. They created embryos through cloning, the same process as Dolly the sheep, and brought them up to about a 10-day gestation or in the dish. And then destroyed them in an experimentation. And the second, the one you're referring to, was the first time in American shores a embryo was genetically engineered with a new invention, which is probably one of the most powerful inventions in the history of the world, and you've heard so little about it. It's called CRISPR, and it permits scientists very easily to genetically alter any organism and any cell. And so what you now see, and hardly even being discussed, much less regulated, is the prospect not only of genetically engineering embryos to try to eradicate certain diseases, but also for human enhancement, a creation of a post-human species, as what's called transhumanism, T-R-A-N-S-H-U-M-A-N-I-S-M, transhumanism, wishes to do. And if your listeners really want to see what people in the high academy want to use these technologies for, do a Google search of transhumanism, and you'll see they want to create a post-human species.
What's your website, Wesley? Where could we see what you've written about this?
Yes, I write on National Review, so go to Wesley J. Smith on National Review, and also my articles archive is at the Discovery Institute. That's discovery.org.
All right, we got to go, Wesley. I'm sorry. It was so brief, but that was very helpful. Thank you so much, folks. When we come back, the inconvenient truth about Al Gore's house. You're listening to Washington Watch.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
If you have no debt except for your mortgage, should you be working to save more? Should you be working to invest more? Should you be using the equity in your mortgage to get some income to invest? Well, no, certainly to the last one. That's what got us in trouble in 2008. So many folks were using the equity in their homes as a piggy bank for what they wanted to do in life as far as investing or other things. So that's definitely out of the question. But look, it goes back to what we always talk about. You've got to have savings. You got to have savings that is going to keep you out of debt. And there is a difference, and this is what I want to point out, between savings and investing. They're not the same thing. Savings, that is money that is totally liquid. For instance, a bank checking account or money market account, it's totally liquid and you can get to it anytime. Investing is means you need to sell something in order to, or divest yourself in order to get that money to do what you'd like to with it. It's very, very different. Investing should always be for the long term. This is for my future. I'm buying some stocks and bonds. Savings is something different. Should you do that with your discretionary income? Yes, but don't forget, pay a little principal on your mortgage and use some of that work to pay hard to get out of that debt and to continue to save. When your savings is sufficient, start investing.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
All right, folks, just a couple of nights ago, I saw Al Gore given an entire hour with Anderson Cooper. An Inconvenient Sequel. That's what he was talking about. Truth to Power. And Al Gore, not retracting his old book, his old movie, An Inconvenient Truth on global warming. A panic approach. I would say an extremist approach, an alarmist approach. Even when many of the predictions in the book and in the film have not come true, he's not backing off. He's not moderating. He's doubling down. An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. And, of course, CNN and Anderson Cooper behind it all the way. Well, we've got someone on the line here to talk about another inconvenient truth, and that's about Al Gore's house. So with us is Drew Johnson. He's senior fellow for the National Center for Public Policy Research. Drew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us about Al Gore's house, because he's saying, you know, in his old book and movie and the current one, you know, that we've got to change our life, our lifestyle. We've got to change the economy. We've got to change the kinds of energy we're using, how we use it. You've uncovered something about his own lifestyle. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a guy, like you were saying, who basically tells us to go down to the creek with a washboard and wash our clothes by hand and then dry it out on a line and walk to work and ride a bike to the store and all this stuff. Al Gore's house, this is one of three houses he owns, mind you. So we're only talking about his house in Nashville. His house in the last year, in the last 12 months, used 21 times more electricity than the average American household. So you and I could run
our house
before. For 21 years on what he uses in a year.
That's a lot. Well, yeah, it's funny because I watched him on Anderson Cooper and just this week, and Anderson brought up the critique of Gore, which is that he's invested heavily in green energy and a lot of these companies and schemes that stand to make millions and millions of dollars as industry buys into it, as the government buys into it, as educational institutions buy into it, as the markets buy into it. That is, that Gore, you know, has leveraged his own investments in such a way as to get rich off of his own writing and his own teaching. And Gore's response was, yeah, I put my money where my mouth is. And he said, I put my money where my mouth is. I believe this, and I'm investing it. So he owned it. He embraced it. But what you're saying is, it's the old cliche, the walk and the talk don't actually match up in his personal life.
Yeah, the measure of a man is what happens behind closed doors. And when he goes to his house, last September, in 1 month, he used 34 times more electricity than the average American does in a month. But what you bring up is a very good point, because the way he burns energy in his own life, when he's telling us this is the most important issue the world is facing, our kids and our grandkids will basically curse our names for not doing more about climate change. He's saying all those things, but I don't think he really believes it, but he has created this sort of religion, this cult out of environmentalism. And he's gotten a lot of people whose hearts are in the right place who believe the environment is important, and it is. And so they see him as some sort of a prophet, but he really is just, he's exploited their concern about the environment to make millions of dollars. He has made $300 million off of environmental concerns, $300 million. So that's what leads me to believe that he just sees this as a really good racket, a way to make a buck or 300 million of them. And like I said, he doesn't really care about the environment. He doesn't care about the people who think he's great. He doesn't care about the climate. He cares about making money and getting some notoriety.
Hey, Drew, look, last question, because some people would ask, where are you getting this data about his house and what he's using? How do we know some of this?
Well, this actually all comes straight from the electric company that serves Nashville. So I'm from Nashville. I lived in Nashville for years and years. And so as a former journalist, I just called one of my sources at the Nashville Power Company, Nashville Electric Service, and got the information. So it's indisputable. He does have solar panels that power about 5% of his annual load.
So confirm this, because I'm reading here, it says 87% of his energy is from fossil fuels and nuclear power. Is that what you understand? Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. So Al Gore has said 100% of my energy is renewable, but really it's not so. That's what comes in through his line is mostly fossil fuels, mostly coal and nuclear and natural gas. So he's a liar.
Wow. Drew Johnson, senior fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research. Drew, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I thought Drew said something very interesting, how people want to take care of the environment. They want to protect the environment. You know, this show, Washington Watch, is not just about politics, but it's about the Christian worldview. And it is true. We do not own this earth. We do not own it. We are stewards. God said, let us make man in our image. And he went on to say, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowls of the air. And he set Adam in the garden to take care of it. And so there is an issue of stewardship. It's not ownership. But to be proper stewards, we can't be hypocrites. To be proper stewards, we can't be alarmists. To be proper stewards, we need to take advantage of the resources that are here and make the most of them. Maybe we can talk more about this later, but we also want to get back to this immigration debate in the White House. How much? What kind? This is Jerry Johnson filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. One of the places we visit on one of the days on our tour of Israel is the Shepherd's Fields. Now, this is a place in Bethlehem. You can look out on any given day and see shepherds with their sheep, as if it were 2,000 years ago during the birth of Christ. So that's a very special place that we visit. Yeah, the terrain would be the same. You can just picture yourself being there the night the angels sang about the glory of the coming of the Lord. That's just one of the places we visit on one of the days. So if you would like to join us on our March 8th through the 16th tour of Israel, we'd love to have you. Just go to the website twholyland.com for more information. twholyland.com or for a free brochure sent to you in the mail, call us at 800-FAMILIES. That's 1-800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, option 5.
I want to say congratulations to the American Family Association on 40 years of ministry.
Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council.
I cannot imagine what America would look like had the American Family Association not been here. I greatly appreciate Don Wildman's vision and his son Tim for carrying that vision forward. So join me in congratulating them on 40 years of ministry, serving the Lord, and serving America.
Volunteering with Operation Christmas Child, I feel like I'm fulfilling a calling.
I've never been on a mission trip, and I don't know if I ever will, but this is my opportunity to spread the gospel.
Volunteering with Operation Christmas Child directly connects you with God's global purposes. Find out how you can invest your skills and passion as part of the year-round volunteer team with Operation Christmas Child. Learn more or apply at samaritanspurse.org/volunteer with OCC.
In college, Catherine Adair became pregnant at age 19 and was very happy to welcome a child. Hi, Kim Katola for Cradle My Heart Today. But she was forced by those around her to abort. She immediately suffered sadness and emptiness and coped with that loss by becoming the world's greatest feminist, as she says. She received a degree in women's studies, marched in Washington, D.C. to support abortion on demand, and started working at Planned Parenthood as an abortion counselor. Catherine reached a turning point, though, when she filled in for another employee who assisted with second trimester abortions. The truth exposed, she began to see that mother and child are one. And she began to pursue her healing through faith in Jesus Christ as she became as passionate to help other women to make a better choice. Find out more of Catherine's time in the abortion industry and her ministry today at cradlemyheart.org. Saving lives and healing hearts after abortion, one story at a time. cradlemyheart.org.
Well, you heard it a few minutes ago, this big debate between CNN's Jim Acosta and Stephen Miller at the White House. And there was this debate about immigration and this claim that Acosta was making that, well, if we're going to get English speakers only, it'll only be people from Great Britain or Australia. And I think Stephen Miller set him straight on that point, and it was very interesting as a piece of political theater. But we're actually more concerned about the substance now at this moment, to think about really the issue of immigration, and not so much even illegal immigration, people sneaking back and forth across the border, smuggled back and forth across the border, the coyotes and so forth, you know, bringing people back and forth. There's all kinds of issues there. But what about legal immigration? That is the planned immigration, the legislated numbers. I mean, what would be the right number and the right kind of people? I mean, certainly there would be some limit. The number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234, because, you know, this week we heard about the RAISE Act introduced by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, David Perdue of Georgia, and President Trump is supporting this. And with us to talk about it, we've got Roy Beck. He is the founder and CEO of Numbers USA. Welcome to the program, Roy.
Hey, Jerry. Good to be with you.
Roy, you've been on this issue for years, and what I want to do is just ask you now to go into the White House, the press room, and we're going to listen for a second to this last interchange between Jim Acosta and Stephen Miller at the White House. And I want your reaction to that, and then let's peel back the layers of the onion after that. Let's listen in.
The notion to think that this is a racist bill is so wrong and so insulting. Jim, the reality is that the foreign-born population into our country has quadrupled since 1970. That's a fact. It's been mostly driven by green card policy. Now, this bill allows for immediate nuclear family members to come into the country, much as they would today, and then it adds an additional point-based system. The people who've been hurt the most, the people who've been hurt the most by the policy you're advocating, are
what policy am I advocating?
Apparently just unfettered, uncontrolled migration. The people have been hurt the most by the policy. The people who've been hurt the most by the policy you're advocating are immigrant workers and minority workers and African American workers and Hispanic workers. And it has
no African American community. Now you brought it up again. You said you wanted to have a conversation and not target. Is it going to be a target?
This is what we want to do.
The African American community, are you going to target? I'm not trying to be funny.
Right, and I know what you're saying. What you're saying is 100% correct. We want to help unemployed African Americans in this country and unemployed workers of all backgrounds get jobs. And insinuations like Jim made, trying to ascribe nefarious motives to a compassion immigration measure designed to help newcomers and current arrivals alike, is wrong. And this is a positive, optimistic proposal that says 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, we want to have an immigration system that takes care of the people who are coming here and the people who are already living here by having standards, by having a real clear requirement that you be able to support yourself financially, by making sure that employers can pay a living wage. That's the right policy for our country, and it's the president's commitment to taking care of American workers. I apologize, Jim, if things got heated, but you take some pretty rough insinuations.
Okay, folks, that was Stephen Miller from the White House, and he was interacting with Jim Acosta. And it was all about immigration and the RAISE Act. Again, Senators Cotton and Perdue have introduced this, and it's to limit or to change, to alter legal immigration. We have an expert who's been studying this for years, Roy Beck, on the line. Roy, tell us, you know, the common American out there, you know, has been thinking mainly about illegal immigration. But you've been studying the issue of legal immigration. How should we be thinking about this?
Well, we've found through the years that a lot of times people assume that everybody they see or you know, run into in their daily life who may not speak English or speak it well or kind of seem foreign, they sort of assume that all those people are illegal. The fact is that most of the people in this country who are foreign-born have come here legally. Over 75% of the over 40, there's more than 40 million foreign-born people in this country. That's a lot of people, and over 75% of those.
So, pause right a second.
Come legally.
So, with a country of over 300 million people, and you said we've got 40 that are foreign-born. So, over 10% of the people here right now were born somewhere else.
Yeah, 15%, which is we're now at the highest. We're at the highest percentage level we've ever been. But of course, for a long time we've been at the highest numerical level, and that happened, you know, very quickly. People may they probably don't know this history, but in the 1980s, immigration had doubled from the 50s and 60s. It went from a quarter million to a half million during the Reagan years, and that was because of laws that were passed back in 1965 and 1980 before Reagan. So, but then in 1990, another law was passed, and it doubled again. So immigration went from 500,000 in the 80s to a million in the 90s, and it's been running a million a year. Every year, our government automatically gives out lifetime work permits and path to citizenship to over a million people around the world. So what this bill does, it looks at it and goes, well, how many of these people do we actually need? How much is good for us? And, you know, the authors of this bill, especially the president, they're concerned about the fact that over half of the foreign-born headed house folks in this country are on some kind of means-tested welfare programs. And it's like, well, what are we doing importing poverty, importing people who can't fully support themselves? Does that make sense? Well, it makes sense in some ways, in the sense if you bring somebody as a refugee or asylee, you know they're not going to pay. You know they're going to need a lot of welfare. That's just part of the system. And you also know that when people marry overseas, we have an unlimited system. If you want to marry somebody overseas, you can do that. But if you're a person who's using welfare, then that immigrant you bring in is going to use welfare
right,
too.
Right.
So that's going to happen. That is not going to change under this bill. But here's what does change. Of those million people, only 140,000 of that million each year are brought in on the basis that some employer says they've got a skill that we want.
Everybody else comes in without any regard to their skill, their education, or whether they're going to be on welfare or anything else.
Pause for a moment. I'm going to make sure I heard that right. So of a million that come in, 140,000 come because some employer wants them because of a skill, you're saying. So that's just slightly over. Well, it's 14%, something like that.
Yeah.
So no
other country in the world has anything like that. So what the authors of the bill do, Cotton and Purdue, they look at this and they go, you know, there's a half million of that million that it really doesn't make any sense for to have those categories at all. One of them is a lottery. The lottery was invented in 1990, and it basically says, you know, there's a lot of countries in this world that don't have many immigrants here, so we're gonna let people pay a fee and play this lottery every year, and we'll randomly pick out 50,000 people and give them lifetime work permits without any regard to anything about them. So that's, they said, we'll get rid of that. And then they said, then there's this chain migration.
Yeah.
And this is something that was started in the late 50s, 1950s. And it, for the first time, it allowed immigrants to choose the next immigrant. So immigrants get to choose, you know, about 30 to 40% of the immigrants are chosen, of the new immigrants are chosen by past immigrants. And they are the adult relatives of immigrants. And so pretty soon you've got parents, you've got brothers and sisters. They get to bring in their spouses. Those spouses bring in their parents and brothers and sisters. It's endless.
Yeah.
None of these people are brought in on the basis of skills, education, anything. This bill says we're going to take away that 1990 lottery, and we're going to take away that 1950s chain migration. And that will stop adding 500,000 people a year who are competing directly, primarily, with our less educated, less skilled members of our society who are having a hard time with real wages that have been declining. And that's mainly what this bill does.
So what you're saying is the higher the numbers that we bring in, it makes it harder for the poor, harder for minorities, the African-American community, harder for the unemployed that are already here.
It really does. And Steve Miller was exactly right. I think he got a little overexcited with the reporter from CNN. But this reporter from CNN had started off recounting this poem that's hung on a plaque inside the Statue of Liberty about "Give me your tired, your poor, you know, your wretched refuse," and you know, as if that was ever the policy of the United States. It wasn't. It never was. And suggesting that this policy is somehow or another un-American, when all it does is go back to what our policy was in the 80s. But this, you know, Stephen Miller was right, and that is, there have been many commissions that looked at it, and they say that even if you don't think immigration is hurting anything else, it is hurting the recent immigrants because they are the most likely to have to compete directly with the new immigrants.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hurting America's poor, who are disproportionately African American and Hispanic American, and they are always the ones that will improve their economic situations will improve the fastest if we reduce legal immigration.
Roy, we've got a caller on the line, and we might have another one. The number is 866-372-7234. It looks like Guana is on the line. Welcome. Do you have a question for Roy Beck or a comment? You're on the air.
Did you say Duana?
Yeah, Guana. Yes, I'm sorry I mispronounced your
name. That's okay. I was going to say, this morning I saw in the news that unemployment is down to the lowest in, you know, 16 years or whatever, and the labor participation rate is the highest it's been ever. And do you know, we have, it's either 38 or 37%, almost 40% of working-age Americans that are not in the labor participation force. And I think when enough of our Republican governors start saying, you know, if you're going to get benefits, you're going to either have to show up 40 hours a week for training for work purposes or work a job to get your benefits, then a lot of these, you know, that will take care of a lot of that. We don't need to keep importing poverty. And I will tell you, they say, well, no, none of the Americans want to do the fruit picking and stuff like that. Well, I think the prisoners, we have to work to pay for their prison costs. I think they should have to work to pay for their own prison costs. I think they ought to, you know, we've tried the liberal soft approach, and, oh, my goodness, that hadn't worked, so we need to go to something else and see if that works, where maybe if they get used to working while they're in prison and stuff like that, then they will work whenever they come out prison and try to stay out of there.
Thanks, Gwen. Roy, what do you think of that?
Well, she's really pointing to two or three really important things, and that is, on the one hand, we're being told by the critics of this bill that unemployment is really low. And official unemployment, called U3 unemployment, of people who are actually looked for work last month, is very low, and that's great. But then, as she says, then the number of people, Americans, who aren't working is still huge. They aren't counted the unemployment rate. We have 50 million, the government says 50 million working-age Americans who aren't in prison, okay? 50 million working-age Americans who aren't working right now. Some of them are affluent. They don't need to work. But most of them are not affluent, and they are not working. And the percent of working-age Americans who are actually working is at one of the lowest it's been since the Great Depression. It's a little bit better now than it was, say, 6 years ago, but it's very, very low. This is a huge bench of available workers, and what's happening is they are living off of government, off of charity, off of extended relatives. They don't live lives of productive dignity. So, many of them would come back in the labor force if businesses would recruit them instead of relying on an immigrant force. And then others of them, as the caller says, they need to be given they need to have some disincentives for not working. But it's ridiculous for America to be importing this much foreign labor every year when we have tens of millions of able working age Americans not working.
Thank you. We're out of time, Roy. Numbers USA, what's your website?
NumbersUSA.com.
All right. Thank you, Roy. Really appreciate it. Well, folks, as we're wrapping up, you need to know whether you're the Russian, Al Gore, an immigrant, or we were talking about those doing the genetic engineering. We're all made in God's image. We have fallen. Sin has marred us and scarred us. This is what the gospel is all about, the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Christ died for our sins. He was buried. He was raised from the dead. This is the Christian message. This is the Christian gospel, the good news of the Lord Jesus Christ. This is Jerry Johnson for Washington Watch, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Thank you for joining us.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.